I and others of us were a bit older, then we had the experience of the Islamic Bank, the mystery of the collapse. No account has been given up to today. And I don't know, nothing is forthcoming. It would be very interesting to see what led to the collapse. We hear stories of mismanagement, we hear stories of hostility from the Reserve Bank. How much of it is fact and how much of it is fiction? I should like someday that some person would actually go into detail and tell us what really happened there, because a lot of people lost a lot of money and a very good opportunity was lost. Now when an opportunity like that is lost, what happens is that generally an air of pessimism sets in. If Jamia Al-Mitr and moreover, if Islamic Bank, what Islamic banking is all about, then we don't want anything of it. This kind of mismanagement, I think it's probably the only bank to have collapsed in South Africa. Generally, if banks are on the verge of collapse, the Reserve Bank doesn't let that happen. They band together and they keep that bank. Well, they did it with Nedbank. They did it before that with one of the banks that eventually became part of the amalgamation of APSA. When you start teetering on the verge of collapse, they don't let, because it will cause a run on the banks. When people lose confidence in one bank, everyone starts coming to the bank and they want to withdraw their savings, and there isn't enough money to withdraw because the monies have been invested elsewhere. So they cannot afford a run on the banks. And they try and keep it. But when it came to Islamic Bank was a stepchild of the South African banking system. So the Reserve Bank probably felt no compunction in pulling the plug on them. And off they went, and many people lost their life savings. Allah Ta'ala replaced it, inshallah, with more and more in the Akhirah. The fact is, it didn't succeed. Normally what would happen is that there should be such a great loss of confidence that people would say this thing wouldn't work. But not in the Sharia of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. This Sharia, there's khayr in his beginning, there's khayr in his end. There's khayr in the middle as well, and even when the sun seems to be setting, we know that he's going to rise again on the other side. We don't lose hope. We stumble, we fall, and we get up and we walk once again. So that came, that failed, and before you know it, all those who were ganging up against Islamic banks once upon a time, are suddenly rushing to open windows of Islamic banks. They're suddenly rushing, standing in a line, phoning all over the place, please, can you advise us on how to put together this, we want to do an Islamic, everyone is into Islamic finance. Everyone is interested in it now. Why? Because they also read the trends. And they also saw that they're at the end of their tether. This kind of banking won't work. This kind of air banking, this kind of investing into something which doesn't exist, into all this kind of derivatives, it can go only so far before the collapse happens. And when the collapse did happen, I think they made it happen a little bit too early, so that the effects of it are not that bad. And we can see the effects of it still over there. But they're pumping money in that. Once the balloon is burst, you can pump money into it. It's like what the Quran says, pouring water in with your fingers open. It's just running through the fingers. But anyway, everyone started seeing now, Islamic banking, that's where we need to go. So what's Islamic banking all about? It's about banking. And in banking, we speak about transactional banking. That, as I said, the least problematic area of banking. I need to make this very, very clear. That when we speak about banking, there tends to be there is the tendency of painting the entire bank, the banking industry with the same brush. Islamic banking, it's either a complete yes or it's a complete no. That is not the way that it is. There are different things that you do in Islamic banking. The one is what? Some person just wants to keep his money in the bank. He doesn't want to buy a car, nor does he want to buy a house, nor does he need trade finance, nor does he want to import from overseas. All that he wants is to keep his money in the bank. So for that person, we say that, look, Islamic banking offers you one of two options. You place your money with the bank on the basis of qard. In other words, what you put in, that's what you'll get back, minus service fees. Or you place it with them on the basis of mudaraba. What you put in, you might not get all of it back, because it depends how well the bank is going to do in the investments that it's going to be doing with your money. And on that, you will be getting a return, minus service fees. But your return will be a variable return. Now, those opposed to Islamic banking and those in favor of Islamic banking, I think they should probably do something, be a bit more circumspect, be a bit more particular. Which side of Islamic banking do you have a problem with? Do you have a problem with the fact that you place your money with a bank and the bank keeps it ring-fenced against all these other funds? It doesn't mix with all the other funds. And there is no riba that's going to be paid out. Well, then people ask another question. They ask another question and they say that, well, if that is what Islamic banking is all about, then tell me, where does the seed funding come from? For bank X, Y, Z to have started an Islamic bank, that means they must have had seed funding to start it off all of with. So where won't that make it haram? You know, one of the ironies of being in South Africa is that our service fees in banks is probably the highest in the world. A few years ago, it came in the papers, the top three or four South African banks were earning something like 35% of their income from service fees. Go elsewhere, you'll see how low the service fees are. They're charging our heads off the service fees. That's the negative side. The positive side is service fees is not riba. Service fees is clean, halal income. So the service being provided is the correct one, it's not riba. So the banks have a fair amount of capital, at least 35% of the capital, which is not riba. So if service fees would come from there, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam had dealings with the Yahud and Nasara, and the Quran says, "Samma'un lil kadhibi akkaluna lis." And tuwfiya Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam wa dir'uhu marhunun 'inda yahudi. He had dealings with the Yahud, even though they akkaluna lis, even though they would take riba. So if a person is taking riba, the fuqaha have a certain approach to it. Is all of his money haram? Is part of his money haram? Half of it? Little of it? In each different instance, they'll give you a different ruling. All of it is haram, don't go. If part of it is haram, makruh. If a little portion of it is haram, then I would ask you another question. Who of us is there who's got absolutely 100% halal and nothing but halal? If we had a bank account that accrues a single cent of interest, then that also reflects on our income. So, we are living in the age which Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam predicted when he said, مَنْ لَمْ يَأْكُلْهُ لَحِقَهُ غُبَارُ. You might, he said, there's a time, everyone's going to be involved in riba. Sahaba says, everyone, he says, who doesn't eat it, at least the dust of riba will be touching him. So, speaking about lily whiteness, speaking about pristine purity, in the age in which we are living, there's a spot on everyone, some way or the other. We're living in that particular age. We are trying to move out of that age into something cleaner. And a change doesn't come overnight. Day doesn't turn into night, just like a flick of a button. Is yuliju al-layla fin nahar, yukawwiru al-layla ala al-nahar, or yukawwiru al-nahara ala al-layl. It's a process. What comes out initially as a little bit of light horizontally on the horizon gradually starts growing from there, growing. Light spreads into the darkness gradually. In this particular instance of coming out of a riba-dominated system, anyone would imagine that the answer would be immediate, in clubs. Yesterday it was riba, today it is. It just doesn't happen that easily. So the birthing process, the pains that it needs to go through, the problems that it needs to go through in order to eventually get where you want it to be, this is the period in which we are living. It's not going to happen all overnight at once. But anyway, to come back, transactional banking, the seed funding problem is not a real problem. It's not a real problem because there's a lot of halal money within these banks. In other words, non-riba money. So for them to have started it from there, there is no problem with that. Then what it offers you is that the involuntary involvement in riba that most of us had for all these years, the need for that has been obviated. Now the qaida says, the rule of fiqh says, الضرورات تبيح المحظورات. Extreme need, it makes halal what is normally haram. But the rest of the qaida must also be taken into consideration. وَتَتَقَدَّرُ بِقَدْرِهَا. The darura will only stretch as far as the need stretches. When the need for having a haram bank account no longer exists, then I would ask any Muslim, why do you still continue? Is it because the returns are better? Is it because you know the bank manager? Because the teller smile at you when you come into the bank? Is it those comfort factors? Or is it the contract that you have with the bank? Is that more important? That should be brought in line with Sharia. Whether one agrees that he's 100% compliant or 50% compliant. Point is, when a better alternative is being provided, make use of it. But it's still the same bank. It'll still bear the same logo of Standard or Nedbank or EBSA. But the transactional basis is different now. It's based upon Mudaraba, it's based upon Qard. It's not based upon the Qard riba we have yesterday any longer. So the first and most important thing, that whether you're a voter, whether you're a supporter, or whether you're an opponent, tell people in the streets to get out of the normal riba that just about everyone is involved in, simply by doing making use of what? of transactional banking accounts, which is in line with Sharia. You do not need to do the second part of banking, which is financing. Financing is a different thing altogether, but your transactional banking, where you put your money, once you put it into this, into the Islamic account, what does it provide? It provides you the peace of mind of knowing that tomorrow, when the casino comes to the bank for funding, your money is not going to go there. Your money is ring-fenced against that. Your money will only be permitted to go into certain areas, but you open a normal account, your money will go anywhere. Your money might go into fighting Islam and Muslims, your money might go into muharabatullahi wa rasuli, into riba. All of those things might go. So what the Islamic account provides you is what? Transactional foundation, which is in line with Sharia. Secondly, ring-fenced against all those other things. Cannot go there, has to be kept apart. It has a virtual balance where every cent deposit into the Islamic account has to be kept separate from the rest. Furthermore, it does something very, very important. What important thing does it do? Till today, as much strides as Islamic banking is making, the majority of our Muslim public are not supporting Islamic banking. The majority are not. Now, supporting it in what sense? Again, not by doing financing. Financing has been problematic from day one of Islam. Not of Sharia, not of Imam Shafi, Abu Hanifa, from the time of Sahaba, Tabi'in already. I'm going to come there just now. That's the next thing we're going to. But transactional banking. The non-Muslim directors of the bank are asking us, why is it that your Muslim people are not taking to this? We've done this for their particular purposes, but the bulk of them still are doing transactional banking in the haram sense. Why is it? I believe, Allahu A'lam, it's on account of the fact that we are unable to separate issues within banking. Transactional banking is a separate issue, and then financing is a separate issue. Financing has been, I come to financing now. What is financing? You need money to buy an asset, you need money to do business, all of those things. What happens there? Either the Qard Hasan, and we've seen how it did not work with Gumush Khanui and others. Or you do what? You do a kind of financing which will provide some returns or the other. In the time of Sahaba radiallahu anhum, they looked at these alternatives to riba. Sayyidina Zayd ibn Thabit radiallahu anhu entered into a kind of contract with a slave woman that he had set free of his own. And the contract entails what? It entails him selling something to her and afterwards repurchasing it at a different price. Something called bay'ul 'ina. It's like this. I want 1,000 rands from you. So what I say, I take out my cell phone. Say, look here, sending you this phone for 1,000 rands. You give me 1,000 rands. And thereafter, immediately thereafter, I buy it back from you. I buy it back from you. The first one was a cash sale. The second one is a credit sale for 1,500. So what? You've given me 1,000. I'm going to pay you back 1,500. And there's a cell phone in between. Now this is a very, very, what do we call it now? Some would call it a fictitious transaction. What really happened is 1,000 hands change hands and will be repaid as 1,500. But it was structured in a way that there is an asset in between. So the first 500 wasn't paid as a qard. The second 500 will not be paid as a return on the qard. It was paid as a thaman, as a price for an article. Is this permissible or not permissible? Zayd ibn Thabit radiallahu anhu regards it as permissible. Sayyida Ummul Mu'mineen, Sayyida Aisha radiallahu anha hears of this. And she says, أَخْبِرُوا زَيْدًا أَنَّهُ قَدْ أَبْطَلَ جِهَادَهُ مَعَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ. Her responsibility is so severe. Tell him, all his jihad with Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is useless if he enters into a contract like this. Our fuqaha look at it afterwards. Some fuqaha, Imam Malik rahmatullahi alayhi, is very, very teleologically minded. When he, in other words, he looks at the ultimate picture. He looks at the picture behind the picture. He doesn't accept any kind of fictitious structures. He says not permissible at all. Imam Shafi'i rahmatullahi alayhi, on the other hand, he looks on. He is the one that says nahnu nahkum bil zawahir, Allah ta'ala sarayir. As far as we are concerned, we only judge you for what we can see. What I see is 1,000 rands in an asset, cash 1,500 rand in asset. Credit, I will judge on that he is near in front of Allah Ta'ala. We don't go there. Therefore, Sadd al-Dhari'ah is not a principle in the Shafi'i fiqh. Imam Abu Hanifa's two students, Imam Muhammad ibn al-Hasan and Imam Abu Yusuf rahmatullahi alayhi. Imam Abu Yusuf rahmatullahi alayhi approves of a bay'ul 'ina kind of structure. A three-sided bay'ul 'ina. One buys and sells with the other, and they bring a third party involved. Imam Muhammad ibn al-Hasan, and look, two students, same teacher. He says, هَذَا الْبَيْعِ عَلَى قَلْبِي كَأَمْثَالِ الْجِبَالِ اخْتَرَعَتْهُ أَكَلَةُ الرِّبَى. This is as heavy as what? This is as heavy on my conscience as mountains is the riba eaters who invented this. One faqih would say, and one as pious as the other, and one as learned as the other. What I'm trying to demonstrate here is that the alternative to riba has been controversial from the times of people much greater, much more able, much more pious than the likes of us. Therefore, I started off originally by saying, there are certain things which were ijma'i, and certain things were mukhtalafi. There are certain things upon which the fuqaha differed. They differed on bay'u salam, they differed on bay'u on ja'ala, they differed on araya, they differed on bay'u al-ina now. So finding an alternative to the riba model has always been problematic. The madhahib arba'a differ, madhahib, the Hanafi madhab in itself is divided on this particular kind of opinion. So when we have a legacy that has come down to us as contentious as this one here, with opinions on both sides, then when Islamic finance is rising out of the ashes once again, and we are trying to look for means to get from zero up to ten, and we started moving from the zero to number three or number four, and people are saying, that's not ten, that's only a four, that's not a ten, that's not a three. We should not be comparing the ten with the three or the four. We should be comparing the three or the four with the zero. It's better than what was. We are getting out of it somehow or the other. Gradually the mindset will eventually take place. But if we try to jump from there completely to an altruistic system of lending, where people will lend purely for the sake of Allah Ta'ala, what's going to happen? The same has happened to Bustanu in Turkey. It's going to come imploding. This is a drop down. It's not going to work. So it's something that needs to be viable. In order for it to be viable, there needs to be some kind of immediate return as well. Here the fuqaha have looked at, how can we finance assets? Financing business, easy enough. You use the mudaraba model. But financing assets, what do you do? The qard hasan is not on. The non-riba loan will not work. The banks do not exist to do favors. And never let them tell you that, as much as they would say it. They don't exist to do favors. They are there to make money. So, how do we go about doing it? Murabaha was the one method that was looked at. Murabaha, but classical murabaha, the one that we engage in the fiqh book, where we speak about tawliya, israq, and murabaha. These are the terms in the Shafi'i works. Elsewhere they'll probably use slightly different terms, but anyway, these are cost-price related sales. My cost is so much and my markup is so much, so I'm giving it to you at cost plus 10. That's a murabaha sale. I bought it for 100 rands, I'm giving it to you for 110. Where the buyer is expressed in terms, the contract is expressed in terms of the cost price. The classical murabaha. That classical murabaha is not the murabaha that we're looking at here. Essentially the model is the same, but it's a two-pronged deal. You want the article, go to the bank. You say, well, I want that particular article. The bank says, okay, that one, I'll buy it for you. But you must promise me then that you're going to buy it, because the bank doesn't exist to buy cars. It will buy the car only if you're going to buy it. We all know what happens to cars. The moment you drive it out of the storeroom, what happens? The value drops by how many percent? So the bank says, I will buy it, I will supply it to you, provided you promise me that you're going to take it. So the person says that, look, I'm signing the papers, I will buy it from you, I promise you. And the next day he comes and he buys it. So the bank bought it for 100,000, the bank then sells it to you for 120,000, which he pays off in installments. That becomes known as al-murabaha lil-amir bishira'i. It's murabaha for the purchase orderer, the person who asks the bank to purchase it. It's through sales. Bank buys from supplier, bank sells to client. And then in between the two, there is this promise that he has to fulfill. Otherwise, what will happen? If everyone starts walking away from the promise that he had made, he says, well, according to all madhahib, promises are not binding. So, I can walk away from this. The bank says for the car, the bank spent 100,000 rands on it, it'll only get 60,000-70,000 rands if it sells it now. What's going to happen next? Banks are going to say Islamic finance doesn't work. Why should we go into Islamic finance if this is what Muslims do? They break their word. They give their word on one day, the next day they turn, and the whole thing will come imploding down. So, the luzumul wa'd, that promise which you made, which kind of ties the two contexts together, that is the area of concern here. Is a wa'd lazim, or is a wa'd not lazim? If you've given your word, must you or must you not? Some fuqaha have written in Asbab al-Nadhair of Ibn Jaymi, quotes I think Bazaziyah, which says that it is possible to make ilzam of a wa'd li hajatin nas. The Malikis are probably ones, the most expansive on this one here. Imam Hattab, in his Tahrirul Kalam, is probably the most detailed discussion of it, where he discusses how, if the wa'd is murtabit bi sabab, if the promise is connected to a certain cause, then that promise becomes lazim qada'an. Not just diyanatan, not just in your conscience, but it can be enforced by a court of law as well. Amongst the Shafi'i fuqaha, most of them say that, to fulfill your promise, not wajib. Qada'an is not wajib. It is only mustahab mandub. Imam Taqiyuddin Subki says no. Look at the nusus, ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu awfu bil uqood, and idha wa'ada akhlafa, and all those kind of things. He says no. You cannot say that diyanatan as well, it is mandub. Diyanatan should be considered as what? Wajib. You have to fulfill that promise. Now, whether one says it is wajib to fulfill the promise, or whether one says it is merely mandub to fulfill your promise, how valid is that contract? No Muslim should break his word. Because over and above, the consequences in Akhirah, there's a very important consideration that our failure to fulfill our promises will lead to an entire collapse of the system through which we are trying to create an alternative to riba. What will happen? This system will collapse. Tomorrow Muslims will go on buying cars as they've been doing for 15, 16, 100 years. But how will they be doing it? Back to HP again. So rather fulfill your promise, whether you believe it to be mandub or mubah, or whether you believe it to be wajib, fulfill the promise. You will be servicing what? You will be you're doing a service to Islam. You're doing a service to this particular aspect, which the world is looking at as the solution of the economic problems. The world is looking at, don't go the HP route, at least there is an alternative. That was the one. The other one, al-ijar al-muntahi bit-tamlik. Said that what? What do you do? You want the car, we'll buy the car. Thereafter, we won't sell the car to you. We'll lease the car to you. Now, for the bank to buy a car, no problem with that. That as a contract is fine. But again, the bank expects you to promise that you will take it on a lease. So the same should be repeated here as what I've said previously about the luzum of the waad. Thereafter, now comes the lease period. Now you pay for the lease period. Let's say 2, let's say 4, let's say 5 years. At the end of the lease period, the bank originally makes you a promise. You do this, then you take it full term. After that, it will be either given to you free of, or for a token sum it will be transferred to you, or for the last payment, whatever it might be. But the transfer mechanism is something which different banks will do differently. But this is basically the way that it works. Which is the contentious element in here? Once again, the promise. But the promise here at two levels. First of all, when the bank has purchased the car, you must undertake to buy it. If you don't, the same applies as previously. Secondly, the bank has undertaken to pass it on to you. Now, someone would say, so what if the bank doesn't? Well, the bank faces a reputational risk. If people come to know that bank XYZ promises you something and they don't do it, they'll be out of business tomorrow. So everyone has a vested interest. Banks, in order to continue their business, and clients, Muslim clients specifically, in order to help with the re-establishment of Islamic finance, Islamic muamalat in the world in which you are living today. Another method that they have used is called al-musharaka al-mutanakhisa. What do? You want to buy a house? Well, the bank says, let you go we're going to partnership. You pay 10% of the purchase price, house costs $1 million. You pay 100,000, we'll pay 900,000. So now we are what? We are partners. Thereafter, bank undertakes, and you undertake as well. Again, the promise comes in. The bank undertakes at regular intervals to cede, to sell part of its 90% to you. And you undertake to purchase it. Now, that undertaking is in order to grease the wheels that it will happen on an ongoing basis. It shouldn't come 1 month and you say, well, in terms of the ahkam of shirka, I'm not bound to buy your part. So you keep your part and I keep mine. You can do that. But it's going to be penny-wise, pound extremely foolish. Your own, you'd have made a point. You'd have proven that no one is bound to do, to act according to the originally given undertaking. You'd have proved the point. But at the same time, you would have caused great harm to an institution that seeks to bring our mu'amalat back into our lives according to the ahkam of Islam. And you will be sending people right back to the jahiliyyah of interest. See, the choice is between what? A system which you might find hobbled in some way or the other, on some account of some fiqhi principle or the other. You say it's not 100%. Man, I look at it this way. If you have a choice between two things, you are being offered on the one hand beautifully marinated and bright khinzir meat. And on the other hand, you are offered this very doubtful mashkuk fi rainbow chickens. Which one of the two are you going to eat? You have to take one of the two. Ma makhtulifa fi jawazihi, something where there's ikhtilaf, Some ulama say jais and some say not jais. Awla mimma ujmi'a ala tahrimihi. All of us say that is haram. What some opponents of the industry are doing now, without understanding where it's leading to, they're telling the people, don't eat those mukhtalafi, those doubtful chickens. Have the khinzir by all means, but don't go over there. That's about as simple as one can reduce it down to. There is no claim that Islamic finance is completely free from problems, completely free from controversy. Why not? Because from the time of Sahaba and Tabi'in radiallahu anhum, it was already controversial back then. They differed. Imam Abu Hanifa and his students differed. Imam Shafi'i and his ustad, Imam Malik, differed on these things. Are you and I going to agree upon things like this? Ikhtilaf was intended to be what? Rahmah for this ummah. When there's ikhtilaf, and we can see the rahmah, what does what rahmah does it provide? It provides you to go to the mukhtalafi instead of the mujma' ala tahrimi. Rather consume that which is slightly, controversial, but going to that which we all know is haram. Which we all know is haram. That is illogical. Extremely illogical. It is short-sighted. It is penny-wise, pound, extremely foolish. So those are some of the ways in which fuqaha in the modern age, and these were not things that were originated by one faqih sitting in the corner of the world working out things all on his own. This project of providing the alternative to riba, this project could never have been the work of one person alone. Who sets the trend for us on how to go about solving these major problems? Sayyidina al-Imam Abu Hanifa, Nu'man ibn Thabit, he wouldn't sit alone and solve his problems. He had a shura al-fuqaha. He had a shura al-fuqaha with him. What do you think? You're the expert in lugha, you're the expert in hadith. Everyone gives their opinions. In this modern age, instead of having just one person solving the particular problems, they've brought people together from all different walks of life, all ulama from all different persuasions. All are not of the same persuasion. All do not dress the same. All do not appear in the same fashion. All do not think along the same lines. But everyone has something to contribute. Because this is not just something which faces this particular Muslim community in South Africa. This is not just something which faces the people in Sudan or Mauritania, or any particular area of the... It is not even just for the Muslims alone. It is something which even the kuffar wa'ala ra'sihim, the Vatican, is looking at as a solution to problems. On the head of it all, the Vatican can see how we can provide solutions. We are still fighting about it. We are still fighting about something which they have realized the Muslims have something to offer us. They see that rainbow chickens are actually the place to go to. But Allahul Musta'an. Then thereafter, so these are the three, or rather, these are the two departments of banking that we looked at. There was banking, transactional banking, then there was financing. Let's move on to the other area. Asset management. Our investment. Investment has been part and parcel of Islam for a long time. You've got surplus funds, you want to know what you do with it. Back then, you give it to a trader. People used to come to Sayyidina al-Abbas, Ibn Abdul Muttalib, so you take the money, you trade with it. And he was a good trader, he would give them returns. That's what it was like back then. But remember, that was the age which Abraham Yudovich, the Jewish scholar at Princeton that I spoke about earlier, he says that in classical Islamic society, you didn't have banks. I mean, a bank is very much a product of the modern world. You didn't have banks in the ancient society. He calls that the society of bankers without banks. We're doing all the functions of banking. Currency changing was taking place. Loans were being given. Partnerships were being formed. Investments were taking place. But there was no institutionalization. What the modern world brought was institutionalization. They institutionalized all of this in one huge conglomerate, one monolith. You go to them and they do your what? It's a one-stop shop. You can do your transactional banking. You can do your financing. And you can do your asset management. Offered. Asset management or investment firms become completely separate entities. They are completely isolated from the banks, and then often the banks have their own arm that does investments as well. But now the market for that would be the stock market. The stock market is the place where investment of this nature takes place. There was a time in South Africa when people were asking, is it permissible, is it not permissible to invest in the stock market? And the answers would be given either as yeses or noes. But the answer cannot be a simple yes or a simple no. Why? Because the matter is simply a bit more complex than a straight yes or a no. What makes it so complex? First of all, there's been a debate in our South African society, in ulama fraternity, among on the issue of the company. With all its attendant aspects of limited liability and all of that. Is a company structure, the structure of a company as we have it there now, where you have shareholders of the company, you don't have the owners, and where, in terms of Western law, where this particular thing developed, where Western law, from the time of Solomon versus Solomon, in 1899, somewhere around there, the British courts gave a ruling that you, the shareholder of the company, you're the owner of the company. You're not the owner of the company, you are merely a what? You have a right to a bundle. You have a bundle of rights. One of the rights is you share the profits of the company, but the company owns itself. You don't own the company. This led some of our colleagues in this country, and perhaps elsewhere as well, in the direction of saying that investing in a company is not permissible, because what does it amount to? The company has an entity, has a juristic personality itself. So if I start a company, I call it ABC Company. That is a different person. When I then take my money and I capitalize the company, I put 100,000 rands into the company,